Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Sairam, dear listener, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma, presented by Professor Jivangatram. Today we present Professor's sixth talk in the current series. Over to Professor Venkatraman.
Loving Sairam and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. This is my sixth talk in the current Dharma series and I have some good news for you. I am done with Duryodhana, that is to say chapter 1 of the book It's Difficult to Be Good by Gurcharan Das, and I am now moving on to the next chapter, which is titled Draupadi's Courage. Like in the previous chapter, the author narrates a bit of the Mahabharata, which in this case takes him just about 8 pages or so to do, and then spends about 20 more pages in analysis. I shall do likewise and go back to the great epic and begin from where we left off earlier. If you recall, we cut off where Yudhishthira, while playing that disastrous dice game with Shakuni, had lost everything, including Draupadi. Whereupon, Shakuni triumphantly cries out, "We have won!" Duryodhana is of course wildly ecstatic. Now that he had won not only the kingdom of the Pandavas, but even Draupadi, he is drunk with pride and promptly orders a messenger to go to Draupadi's chamber and bring her forthwith to the assembly. Here is how Das describes it by quoting the epic. "Bring Draupadi, the beloved wife whom the Pandavas honor. Let her sweep the house and run our errands. What a joy to watch." Sensing danger, Vidura, the wise advisor to Dhritarashtra, tries to dissuade Duryodhana from behaving rashly, but he fails to do so. Duryodhana wants his moment of revenge and is impatient. Haughtily he repeats his order to the messenger, who then hastens to the queen's chamber. The messenger is most uncomfortable. I mean, it was against prevailing norms to enter the area occupied by women. On top of it, this man had to enter the queen's chamber and tell her that she is being summoned by Duryodhana. Somehow, drawing all the courage he could from within, the messenger tells Draupadi, and once again I quote from Das, "Intoxicated on dice, Yudhishthira has lost you, O Draupadi. You must come now to Dhritarashtra's house." Draupadi is stunned, shocked and furious, naturally. Consumed by rage, she shouts, her voice trembling. As earlier, the words are from Das. Draupadi says, "What son of a king would wager his wife? The king is befooled and crazed by the game." Draupadi then orders the messenger to go back to the assembly and ask her husband, "Whom did you lose first, yourself or me?" Happy to get away, the messenger races back to the assembly and conveys to Yudhishthira the question posed by Draupadi. Interestingly, the messenger does not repeat Draupadi's question verbatim, but instead tells the assembly that Draupadi wanted Yudhishthira to clarify, "As the owner of whom did you lose us?" Yudhishthira does not respond and remains still like a stone. Meanwhile, Duryodhana, who was expecting the queen in the assembly, is infuriated that Draupadi had merely sent back a question for her husband to answer. angrily he tells the messenger to go back and order Draupadi to come to the assembly and personally put to her husband the question she had conveyed. The messenger bows and leaves, goes back to the Draupadi's chamber and says, once more I turn to Das for his recall of the Mahabharata. The messenger says, the kings in the hall are summoning you. It seems the fall of the Kurus has come. Princess, when you are led into that hall, the king would be too weak to protect our fortunes. Back in the assembly, Duryodhana is waiting impatiently for Draupadi's entry. The messenger had been gone for quite some time and still there was no show by the queen. Fuming with rage, Duryodhana then orders his brother Dushasana to personally go to the inner chambers and bring the reluctant queen to the public. Overjoyed by the task assigned, Dushasana rushes to Draupadi's chamber and drags her by the hair. Even as she is pleading with her torment to leave her alone, his response was, come, come, you are one. Enjoy the Kurus. With slaves, one delights as one wishes. The assembly is shocked as Dushasana enters the hall, dragging Draupadi behind him. The silence of deep shock fills the assembly and no one speaks. As Draupadi slowly looks around, casting a glance that is both scorching and contemptuous. Finally, the family patriarch Bhishma, much respected for his wisdom, rises to speak. Bhishma was truly in a quandary. He loved the Pandavas and in his heart he knew that what was happening was unquestionably wrong and absolutely immoral. And yet, this was an assembly, and as an elder, Bhishma wants to appear neutral. So, he sets aside the basic issue, which is a fundamental moral question, and tries instead to deal with the problem at what may be called a technical and legal level. Bhishma thus begins by observing that when a person has wagered himself and lost, he really wants nothing. In that sense, Yudhishthira really could not offer Draupadi as a wager. On the other hand, Draupadi being his wife was an inseparable part of her husband and bound to him no matter what. In a sense, by converting a fundamental moral question into a purely legal one, Bhishma is essentially trying to say that although it was pretty horrible, it could be argued that Draupadi had been fairly wagered and duly lost. At the same time, his heart does not agree. Finally, Bhishma ends up saying that the matter was too complex for him and that he could not really resolve Draupadi's dilemma. He had really thrown up his hands. Draupadi is of course shocked by Bhishma's pronouncement. The elders remain quiet and do not either support or contradict Bhishma. That was when Vikarna, the younger brother of Duryodhana, gets up and raises his voice in support of Draupadi. The best of men, Vikarna begins, are prone to vices, of which there are many, one of them being gambling. Addiction to vices, even if it be just only one, is tantamount to abandoning dharma. Yudhishthira had a weakness for the dice game and that weakness was played up to entice him to play a dice game. When Yudhishthira had lost everything including himself, he was taunted to wager his wife. It was Yudhishthira's weakness that made him yield to external pressure and agree to offer Draupadi as a bet. The bet was clearly illegitimate and thus wrong. There was therefore no question of Draupadi having been lost by the Pandavas and won by the Kauravas. This time, there was a roar of approval from the assembly. Vikarna had put the matter in clear perspective, making it abundantly clear that in his view, Draupadi was free, though her husband had consciously gambled himself into slavery. Unable to contain herself, Draupadi now decides to speak out and asserts that firstly, Yudhishthira had a weakness for the dice game, which was cleverly exploited by the Kauravas. Next, aware of Shakuni's propensity to cheat, Yudhishthira makes, right at the beginning of the game, an explicit appeal to Shakuni by telling him, Shakuni, don't defeat us by cheating. Moreover, argues Draupadi, after a run of failures, no doubt due to non-stop cheating by Shakuni, Yudhishthira became temporarily insane after losing all his material assets. It was the temporary insanity of Yudhishthira that led him to then wager humans, something never done in a dice game. Actions performed when a person is temporarily insane, argued Draupadi, are unacceptable under law. Burning inside deeply from the insults he had suffered in the past from the Pandavas, Karna gets up and explodes. Draupadi, Karna roars, belonged to the Kauravas, having been won fair and square. She was not worth being called a queen, for queens do not have multiple husbands. Only cheap women of low character do so, and Draupadi thus deserved to be treated like one. While such legal arguments were being tossed back and forth, there was Dushasana holding the queen of the Pandavas, with no one in the huge gathering daring him to behave with decency and treat a queen with the dignity due to her, especially in a public assembly. Instead, the moment Karna sits down, Dushasana takes Karna's words seriously and begins to undress Draupadi with everyone in the huge assembly watching. Let me turn to Das for a description of what happened then. I quote, Draupadi cries out, "This foul man, disgrace of the Kauravas, is molesting me and I cannot bear it any longer." Then an extraordinary thing happens. When her dress was stripped off, another similar dress appeared every time. A terrible roar went up from all the kings, a shout of approval, as they watched the greatest wonder on earth. And in the end, a pile of clothes was heaped up in the middle of the hall when Dushasana, tired and ashamed, at last desisted and sat down. The men in the assembly raise a cry of shame, shame. They clamor for an answer to Draupadi's question. End of quote. Vidura the wise then says, Draupadi raised a question, and instead of giving her an answer, she was allowed to be molested in public. Men in the hall, at least now give her an answer. She is entitled to it. When a person raises a dharmic question and demands an answer, a proper answer must be given. Otherwise, dharma would be offended. Quoting sage Kashyapa, Vidura declares that when evil is afoot, it is immoral to stay aloof and silent. In such a situation, everyone wounds dharma and is therefore automatically guilty of committing adharma, both the perpetrator and the silent witnesses. Karna, however, would have none of it. In his view, Draupadi was wagered and won in a game fair and square. Addressing Draupadi, he tells her haughtily, "Your husband has become a slave and property. He thus no longer has any property of his own. As for you, you too are nothing but property." Turning then to Dushasana, Karna says, "Take away this servant maid to the inner chambers." Everyone in the assembly is utterly overwhelmed by the sequence of events culminating in what seemed like divine intervention. Even as Karna orders Draupadi to be taken inside, presumably to join the servants there, Draupadi gives vent to her feelings with these words, courtesy author Das. "Methinks that time is out joint. The Kurus allow their innocent daughter-in-law to be molested. What greater humiliation than that a woman of virtue and beauty? What is left of dharma of the kings?" Even as Draupadi is pouring her anguish, Duryodhana makes a highly offensive and obscene gesture to the distressed queen. Vidura is shocked and he rises to warn the Kauravas that they have overplayed their hand and that the day would come when they would pay dearly for their excesses. As if to confirm Vidura's dire prophecy, there were ominous omens of various kinds. Deeply shaken by all these dramatic developments, Dhritarashtra steps in. He calls Draupadi and tells her, "O noble one, you are the most righteous wife and the most distinguished among my numerous daughters-in-law. You have correctly sought for dharma and it is my duty to support your demand. Please ask for whatever wish, and I shall see that your wish is fulfilled." For Draupadi, this was a most unexpected turn. But quickly realizing the importance of the moment, she asks for Pandava's freedom. Dhritarashtra not only promptly agrees, but also orders that everything that Yudhishthira had lost in terms of property be fully restored back to him. A sensational ending to a conflict conducted not with arms and a battle, but via a flawed dice game. The story must have ended there, at least in a substantial measure, but it did not for two reasons. Firstly, there was a fundamental question raised by Draupadi as to who owns whom. And secondly, Yudhishthira was fated to repeat his mistake. One does not know whether to refer to the latter as simply sad or utterly stupid. But that is life, and if we introspect, we would find that a good many of us do make stupid choices when moral dilemmas are concerned. As I told you, Das uses the epic to raise an issue and then spends time on discussing various aspects in his effort to obtain a definition of dharma from the Mahabharata. That is what we saw in chapter 1 of his book, and we see the same now in chapter 2. Das basically raises four issues, and they are as follows. 1. The miracle that saved Draupadi's modesty. 2. Draupadi's question as to what exactly is the dharma of a king. 3. Is slavery moral or immoral? And finally, does dharma mean a discipline of ordered existence? Given his literary as well as writing skills, Das takes us through a fascinating discussion of these topics that extend roughly over 20 pages. I mentioned this before. And it's my task now to take you on a tour of those argument-packed pages. We begin with the unexpected appearance of the endless sari that not only saved Draupadi, but also humiliated Dushasana, who, with much bravado, thought he would publicly humiliate Draupadi because she dared to stand up to them and pose a deep question. As things turned out, it was the villain Dushasana who got utterly humiliated. And clearly the humiliation occurred in a totally unexpected manner as the result of an intervention by an unseen and unknown agency. How did this miracle happen? Who performed that miracle and why? Most people in the huge assembly sympathized with the unfortunate Draupadi, but few dared to speak in support of her, and fewer still came forward to physically help her, including her 5 husbands. But when the time came, there was an outside intervention that was nothing short of miraculous. How did this miracle happen? Who performed that miracle? And why? It is important at this stage to quote what Das says, for he is basically of the rationalist type that does not believe in miracles. And yet, he does accept that something extraordinary did happen to save Draupadi. Here is what he says, and I quote, "What did in fact happen that day? How did an inexhaustible stream of garment appear from nowhere to protect Draupadi? Popular versions of the epic as well as many ancient bhakti redactions invariably show Krishna coming to her rescue. We shall never know what the original Mahabharata was like, but it seems clear to many scholars of the epic that the epic was reworked early on, as early as the 5th century BC, by Vaishnava redactors to glorify Krishna. The disrobing of Draupadi gave them an opportunity to bring in Krishna in order to save her. As her clothes are being unraveled, she thinks of Krishna and appears to him. Dost thou not see the humiliation the Kauravas are forcing upon me? O Krishna, save a distressed soul sinking amid the Kauravas." In the scholarly Pune critical edition of the epic, however, there is no Krishna and the miracle is left unexplained. Frank Edgerton, editor of Book 2 of the epic, Sabha Parvan, had the unenviable task of having to select from more than 100 manuscripts. In the end, he and his colleagues decided on the version without Krishna. He argued that it was cosmic justice that protected her. Draupadi was a chaste and a just woman committed to dharma. Edgerton argues forcefully and says, "No prayer by Draupadi, no explanation of the miraculous replacement of one garment by another, no mention of Krishna or any superhuman agency. It is apparently implied, though not stated, that cosmic justice automatically or magically, if you like, prevented the chaste Draupadi from being stripped in public." I tend to agree with Edgerton. I believe the narrative is stronger without Krishna. The text is briefer, simpler and quicker. It helps build Draupadi's character. It is her own agency, her own dharma, which is responsible for the miracle rather than God's intervention. Well, that was a long quote from Das, and it illustrates how scholars and historians, while sympathetic to our epics, do struggle to keep it secular and free of God. Frankly, I am quite fascinated by the fact that Gurcharan Das, who does not believe in God, is nevertheless not willing to dismiss the story of the endless sari as a fabrication. Furthermore, he is willing to talk about A, cosmic justice, and B, a miracle. The epic says that the incident did happen and Das quietly accepts it instead of disputing it as intellectuals are expected to. And for this, I heartily commend Das. His only assertion is that Krishna had nothing to do with the incident of the endless sari. To summarize, as far as Das is concerned, A, the episode of the endless sari is true, B, it was clearly a miracle, and C, it probably was a manifestation of cosmic justice. Okay, the question now becomes, where on earth did that endless sari come from? What was the agency behind it? What is this cosmic justice and how did it get triggered by something that happened in an assembly on a tiny planet called the Earth, where a fraudulent dice game had just concluded? Das says nothing regarding these questions. The only thing is clear about is that Krishna had little to do with this incident. Das agrees that there was a king named Krishna who actually got himself involved in the Kurukshetra war and helped the Pandavas to win the war through guile and cheating. As for Krishna the god, Das maintains that it is fiction inserted by the Vaishnavites, who came later. In other words, the Gita is not in the original version of the Mahabharata, being a later insertion that was made to blend with the epic. The god Krishna inserted later, Das seems to suggest, was conveniently linked to the episode of the endless sari as a way of illustrating the power of the divine and how it comes to the rescue of the faithful. To me, this business of invoking cosmic justice and denying God at the same time is like having the cake and eating it too. Let me dig a bit deeper into this business of cosmic justice by going back to an incredible speech of Mahatma Gandhi recorded in 1931 when Gandhiji was in England for the second roundtable conference. This talk, labeled as a spiritual message to the world, is a favorite of mine, and regular listeners would be aware that I frequently make references to it. Gandhi begins that speech I referred to with the following words: "There is an indefinable mysterious power that pervades everything. I feel it, though I cannot see it." End of quote. Okay. Granted that there is an unseen mysterious power all around us, filling the cosmos too. Can Gandhi say anything more about this mysterious power? He sure does, and does it as follows. Quote, "It is this unseen power which makes itself felt and yet defies all proof because it is so unlike all that I can perceive through the senses." End of quote. The above quote simply tells us Gandhi is able to say very little about the mysterious and unseen power, other than A, it exists, and B, that it is quite different from what one perceives via one's senses. What is it that is so different about this mysterious power? Here is Gandhi's answer, quote, "It transcends the senses." End of quote. Okay, so there is this mysterious power, which is omnipresent, which we can experience, though it is beyond the senses. We can experience but cannot quite prove that it exists. Fine, we accept all that. What more can Gandhi add? He says that it is also possible to argue why such a power, which by the way Gandhi now begins to refer to as God, ought to exist. Here is how the Mahatma makes his case for God. Quote, "Even in ordinary affairs, we know that people do not know who rules or why and how he rules. And yet they know that there is a power that certainly rules. In my tour last year in Mysore, I met many poor villagers and found upon inquiry that they did not know who ruled Mysore. They simply said that some god ruled it. If the knowledge of these poor villagers was so limited about their ruler, I, who am infinitely lesser in relation to God than they to their ruler, need not be surprised if I do not realize the presence of God, the King of Kings. End of quote. Gandhi continues, and I quote him once more, "Nevertheless, I do feel, as the poor villagers felt about Mysore, that there is orderliness in the universe. There is an unalterable law governing everything and every being that exists or lives. It is not a blind law, for no blind law can govern the conduct of living beings. And thanks to the marvelous researches of Sir J.C. Bose, it can now be proved that even matter is life. That law then, which governs all life, is God. Law and the lawgiver are one." End of quote. I hope you have been able to follow the flow of logic in the Mahatma's arguments. Recall that he begins by saying that there is a mysterious power all around us. Not only that, unknown to us, this power governs all there is, including you and me. This power, therefore, is the master of all of us. Gandhi next argues that since there is orderliness in the universe, there must be an unalterable law governing everything and every being that exists or lives. And that law which governs all life, declares Gandhi, is God. We thus have a unique situation, which is that God is not only the ruler and the one who lays down the law, but is also the law itself. And that is what makes Gandhi declare law and the lawgiver are one. This most important observation is in no way Gandhi's original discovery. The Mahatma was merely echoing an old Upanishadic declaration, which is Satyam Jnanam Anantam Brahma, which Swami made the basis of a bhajan. If you recall, while singing the bhajan, Swami would say Satyam Brahma Jnanam Brahma, etc. Well, if Satya or truth is God, so must also be the case with Dharma, since Dharma is nothing but Satya in action. Let's put all this together. If we do so, we get the following. Firstly, anyone who meticulously adheres to Dharma through actions performed is automatically expressing adoration to God, even though the person may not be quite aware of it. Nevertheless, God takes due notice of this adoration, and when his devotee is in difficulty, he rushes immediately to the rescue. As some of us are aware, the Puranas of India are full of stories of how God has rushed to the aid of his devotees. It turns out that these acts of divine compassion can also be put in some kind of a scientific language by saying that dharmic actions of the individual generate resonance in Dharma as a cosmic force. Draupadi must clearly have built up a strong dharmic credit balance, so that when she was being assaulted by the forces of Adharma, the power of cosmic dharmic resonance generated by her came to her rescue. In my view, this is the only way one can understand cosmic justice. In this context, we should not forget the ancient saying, Dharmo Rakshati Rakshaha, meaning that Dharma protects those who faithfully abide by it. So, to get back to the point I was making, if Mr. Das says that cosmic justice came to the rescue of Draupadi, I would heartily agree with him. However, if at the same time Das insists on denying God, then he must explain what exactly he means by cosmic justice and how it intervened in Draupadi's case. If there is a cosmic force like, say, the gravitational force that pervades the entire universe, then Das must say something about the origin of that force, its properties, and how it is sensitive to human actions, how it knows whether an action is just or not, etc. You can't just mention a concept and leave it at that. I know You would at this point challenge me with the argument. But you have not explained the cosmic force either. You have just done a bit of hand-waving using the Mahatma as support. So how can you complain about this? I concede it's a fair point and let me respond. To start with, we should recall the Vedic declaration that God is not only beyond words, but He is also beyond that powerful entity called the mind. Given those two facts, it's a futile exercise to use science for explaining God. As Gandhi himself says in his famous talk, He is no God who merely satisfies the intellect. God to be God must rule the heart and transform the senses. That being said, being immersed in the world of names and forms, we ordinary humans do need to have some idea of who or what God is and how we ought to relate to Him. This is where great philosophers, both from the East as well as the West, come to our help by explaining who God is and so on. Okay, so here we have God who is eternal, changeless, nameless and all that. We are supposed to have been created by this God, but unlike God Supreme, we are made of material stuff. We have a form, delicately crafted I might add. We have a finite size, we have senses that help us experience the world we live in. And we have a mind whose power, as Krishna tells us in the Gita, comes directly from Him. Despite all this, there is a wall which we cannot cross, and that's the wall of Maya, which keeps us confined below the mind and the senses. So we really can't say much about God from this side of the wall. Nevertheless, it is certainly useful to have a concept about God, since it's of practical value in the journey towards God. With that preamble, let me get to the point. Now, in modern physics, we deal with quantities that are too esoteric for easy comprehension. However, they do help us explain the world we normally experience using our senses. Let us start with the atom, of which all matter is supposed to be made. Over a century and a half ago, the atom was considered to be something like an incompressible billiard ball. Today, we have a much more sophisticated view of the atom. The atom is not a solid sphere. Rather, it has an internal structure, somewhat like our solar system, whose details can be understood via the use of a complicated theory known as quantum electrodynamics, or QED for short. There are two reasons why I am bringing in all this. Firstly, QED, which the brilliant physicist Richard Feynman described as the jewel of physics, deals with all sorts of sophisticated and abstract concepts, including a vacuum field and matter emerging from it. Keep this in mind as a quote for you what Freeman Dyson, who played a key role in making some of the subtleties of QED comprehensible to the working physicist, has to say. Here is Dyson speaking. Even to a hardened theoretical physicist like me, it remains perpetually astonishing that our solid world of trees and stones can be built of subtle quantum fields and nothing else. This is a most thought-provoking statement by a very serious physicist. Science can explain all of matter in terms of abstract field associated with three types of quantum field theories, whereas you and I perceive matter via entities like mountains, rivers, clouds and whatnot. The point that I am making is that while engaging in a serious discussion of reality, we should not be carried away entirely by what our senses tell us. Indeed, senses never tell the full story even where inert matter is concerned. What then to say about subtler entities like life, consciousness and of course God? Keeping all this in mind, as also the various caveats offered earlier, I would say that Brahman can be regarded as something like the vacuum of quantum fields theories and the source of consciousness as well as life, just as the vacuum of quantum field theories is the source of matter and force. Maybe in later talks I shall come back to this topic and amplify, but for now it is possible to think of God by analogy with quantum fields. I add the caution that this analogy is only for the purpose of conceptualization and is not meant to suggest in any way that one day we could have a quantum field theory of explanation of God. There is no way in that can happen for the simple reason that physics is bound by space and time while God transcends them. Some of you may think that I have digressed too far and might be wondering what is the point I am trying to make. To appreciate the point I am trying to make, let us get back to cosmic justice. If God could be visualized like a field in physics, say the gravitational field, then cosmic justice could be likened to a gravitational wave coming from the gravitational field generated by the sun and impacting, say, the earth. No one can deny that matter and inert energy that make up most of the cosmos have a mysterious origin that present-day science can explain fairly well. Can science explain consciousness and life alone? No, it cannot. However, it is possible to argue that the origin of life and consciousness must be conceptually similar to the way matter originates from quantum fields. That is the point I am trying to make. These are points that are being discussed today by present-day scientific philosophers. So things are in a melting pot, but I am quite sure in a few years we will get more clarity about it. Meanwhile, I wish to argue that Das is right in talking about cosmic justice, only he fails to connect it to the divine, which I find to be incorrect. And Gandhi explains this using utterly simple language. So let me end with Gandhi, who says, I may not deny the law or the lawgiver because I know so little about it or him. Just as my denial or ignorance of an earthly power will avail me nothing, even so my denial of God and his law will not liberate me from its operation. Humble and mute acceptance of divine authority makes life's journey easier, even as the acceptance of earthly rule makes life under it easier. End of quote. Das wants to distill Dharma from the Mahabharata. The great epic tells the tales of many people, both good and bad. If one looks carefully, those who hung on to the moral compass and humbly followed Krishna's advice were, in the end, able to complete life's journey far more satisfactorily than those who did not. And that moral compass did not come from nowhere. It came from the lawgiver, namely God. Once again, I am left wondering why Das insists on excluding God from the governance of life when he is the one who gave us life in the first place. I stated earlier that Das discusses four topics in chapter 2, starting with the miracle that saved Draupadi's modesty. This talk has been taken up entirely by the discussion of just the first topic, and that means I have to put off the other topics occurring in chapter 2 to later talks. Well, that's all I have for you today, and I thank you for listening. God bless, and Jai Sai Ram. Offering this talk to Swami, I now bring it to a close. Hope you would remain in touch with this series and draw more people into the fold of its listeners.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end talk number 6 in the current series on Dharma presented by Professor Jeevankatraman. Dear listener, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org, and if you don't mind, kindly draw the attention of people who have missed this program to listen to it by downloading the podcast, which is available on our website www.radiosai.org. Thank you and Sai Ram.
Spend the day with Sai. From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m.
on Radio Sai's Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned. I had a lot of fractures, I had a lot of bruises and I had breathing problems, but it was Baba, Baba, Baba every day. With every breath, with every step I would take while running, it would be Om Sri Sai Ram.
Well, it actually all started with my mother getting a vision of Swami. This was in 1970 when she was cooking.
There were lots of roses and of course tiny little rosebuds which was nowhere ready to bloom. And he just touched it with his finger.
Mm-hmm.
And just like a movie or a video,
mm-hmm.
right in front of my eyes, you know, this rosebud started to get bigger and bigger and bigger and opened out into a beautiful rose.
Love all, serve all. We've made as famous as Swami has at the Hard Rock because we put it on millions and millions of t-shirts, jackets, buttons, badges, everything. If you got your check, if you work for me at the top, love all, serve all. We put huge signs up in every restaurant around the world.
Tryst with Divinity is our weekly series in which we bring you conversations with devotees of Bhagwan Baba from around the globe. You can listen to this on Asia Stream of Radio Sai every Thursday at 9:50 a.m. and 8:30 p.m. To know more about the timings of this weekly series, Tryst with Divinity, on other streams of Radio Sai, please go to the schedule page of our website radiosai.org, or you can also download and listen to any interview of your choice in this series at your leisure by visiting the link radiosai.org/tryst. That is radiosai.org/tryst or tryst. Thank you and happy listening. Sai Ram.
Shri Raghavam Dasharatatmajam Prameyam Sitapatim Raghukulanmaya Ratnadeepam Ajanubahum Aravinda Dalayataksham Ramam Nishacharam Vinashakaram Namami Namami Raghunandana Dasharatha Nandana
Shri Raghunandana Dasharatha Nandana
Badra
हे विश्वनाथ हे गौरीनाथ हे साईनाथ भगवान हे गौरीनाथ हे साईनाथ भगवान दया करो
भगवान साईनाथ भगवान